The Hoop Heads Podcast is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I've been a head coach at Yale for 25 years. I have never had one kid transfer. Not one time has a kid knocked on my door and said, hey, coach, this isn't what you said it was going to be. I'm not happy here. I want to transfer. And I think a lot of that is because we vet the right people. But while they're at our university, we make sure they understand what they need to do to be successful. And they get to go to practice every day to prove that.
James Jones is the men's basketball head coach at Yale University. He's the all-time winningest men's basketball coach at Yale and one of the most successful coaches in Ivy League history. James was named Yale's head coach on April 27, 1999. He enters the 2023-2024 season with 373 career victories. Jones, the longest tenured coach in the league, has guided the Bulldogs to 5 Ivy League championships, 4 NCAA tournament berths, and 8 postseason appearances. Jones, the 2019 recipient of the Ben Jobe Award as the top minority coach of Division I men's basketball, has presided over the most successful era in the long history of Yale basketball. Over the last 8 seasons, Yale has posted an 84-28 Ivy League record, won 5 Ivy championships, 2 Ivy League tournament titles, and earned 4 NCAA tournament berths, including notching the first NCAA victory in school history over Baylor in 2016. Jones, who was inducted into the New England Basketball Hall of Fame in 2015, is a 3-time Ivy League Coach of the Year and also has been named the NABC District 13 Coach of the Year 3 times. Jones began his coaching career as an assistant at his alma mater, the University at Albany, followed by assisting coaching stops at Yale and Ohio University. Hey, Hoopheads, get your team ready for this season by shopping Dr. Dish's all-in sales event and receive an exclusive $3,000 off their top training solution, the CT Plus. Dr. Dish is here to help your players have no regrets, just results, and be all in this upcoming season with exclusive offers on their top shooting machines now during the Dr. Dish September all-in sales event. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Ryan Larson, Women's Basketball Associate Head Coach at the University of Wyoming, and you are listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Be sure to take some notes as you listen to this episode with James Jones, men's basketball head coach at Yale University. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, but I am pleased to be joined by James Jones, the men's basketball head coach at Yale University. James, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Hey, thanks. Great to be on with you.
Thrilled to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do in your career. Want to start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of the first experiences you had with the game of basketball. What made you fall in love with it?
Well, you know, it's part of the family thing. I had an older brother that played. My dad played in high school. And, you know, we, you know, came from, you know, a background that, you know, lower middle class. But my dad had put up a hoop in our backyard and didn't play on cement. We played on a dust dirt court, which was, you know, you had to, like, spray water on so the dust wouldn't come up in the summertime. And, you know, it was just a great place to learn and play. And, and, you know, just really enjoyed it. And I grew up in a neighborhood where we probably had, I don't know, 100 kids within a 4 or 5 year range of each other. So it was a very new neighborhood. And, you know, all we did was play sports all day. We were playing basketball or baseball or football. We were always doing something. But hoop was just, you know, a love of mine.
What was the competitiveness like with your brothers?
Well, as you can imagine, I mean, that's what happens when you grow up. You know, you fight like cats and dogs against your brother and your brothers, actually, I should say. And it's just how it goes. And, you know, we would have wars against neighbors, though. It was three of us and three of them. And we played 3-on-3 against the butlers that lived next door. And but when it came down to going head to head, I was fortunate that I was a little bit. I had one older brother who was 4 years older than me, and I really couldn't compete with him because he was just so much bigger and stronger. And then I had two younger brothers that were each 1 year apart. So there were three of us in a row. And, you know, I was a little bigger and stronger than the two of them. And I was able to, you know, beat them 2-on-1, which was great for me growing up. But, you know, competing against your brother is kind of where it starts and, you know, how you get that bite and that energy to be successful outside the family.
Obviously, at that time, when you're growing up, the way you come up in basketball from a youth standpoint is completely different from the way that kids come up through the game today. They weren't trainers. You weren't playing AAU basketball. So when you started to take the game a little bit more seriously as you got older, what'd you do to try to get better? Did you have a plan for working out, or was it more just, hey, I'm playing pickup games and I'm trying to compete with my brothers, or were you more formal than that?
Well, you know what? Like when I was a kid, it was a whole different world, right? There were no workout guys. There was no gym to go into. You just played outside. You got in the park. And, you know, I remember as a kid, you know, going down to the junior high school that was a block away from my house where we all played. And I remember going up to the guys on the court and asking if I can get some run. And they looked at me at 7, 8, or 9 as I was, and they told me I could run around the track, but I wasn't going to run playing. So, you know, you had to make sure that you're going to get better. And, you know, I went from being that guy to being a guy who was always picked and, you know, everybody wanted on your team. So it's just one of those, you know, things that, you know, growing up and you just learn so many different things and so many different lessons from playing basketball about yourself and how to be better and, you know, but there was no formal training. It was all about just going out and playing. And I remember as a kid thinking that I was going to go down to this park that, and they had like 6 courts down there and I was going to make 10 jumpers on each court before I go home. And in my mind, I did that, but never physically did it. You know, it's just one of those things that, and I believe it's one reason why I'm a coach. Because I couldn't motivate myself to do what I knew was right. So I try to motivate others to try to become the best versions of themselves because I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it for myself personally. I needed somebody helping me out, and I didn't have that guy.
Yeah, that was actually going to be my next question, if you had anybody at the park. Or I know that in that era when you and I grew up that there were guys that are older that are kind of sometimes looking out for those younger guys that are coming up to the playground and kind of put their arm around them and sort of show them the ropes. But it sounds like you didn't have that particular person that you were able to find. And so you're kind of going at it by yourself. As you get into high school, what do you remember about being a high school player? Do you have a favorite memory from high school basketball?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Like when I was a senior in high school, we played against Long Island Lutheran. You got to help me out here. The former coach down at Davidson, Bob McKillop.
Bob McKillop, yep.
Yeah, Bob was the coach at Long Island Lutheran, and we played them on a televised game, and they had an all-day squad, and they might have beat us by 25 in a game. But I had a dunk on TV, and that was just one of those things that you'll always remember, you know, as a kid, because, you know, I started dunking in 10th grade, and when I was dunking in 10th grade, I was like the only guy in my group that could dunk, And now everybody dunks a basketball.
Absolutely.
You got a dude 4'11", and he's tomahawking on you already. So it was just a different world. And to have a dunk on TV is one of those great memories that I had. And I had a couple of games where I was unconscious. We played against Amityville at home. I remember I went for like, you know, 18 in the first half or something like that, and ended up with 28 or something like that in a game. It was just one of those games that you felt like you couldn't miss. So You know, those memories, you know, are never lost. And coincidentally, one of the a team that I played against in my league was Harborfields. And there was a guy that was on that team, and he actually brought his kid to my elite camp here a couple of weeks ago that you were at. And I had a picture of the two of us jumping center when we were in high school. And like, think about it, I was 6'1", I was jumping center. That's how crazy things were.
That's awesome. I mean, just again, the memories of being able to go back and reconnect with somebody that you were connected to so long ago. Do you still have that dunk on tape?
You know what? I don't. Like, you know, now, like, you know, now in today's age, you certainly have that. I'd have it on speed dial on my phone and be able to dial up for you. You know, the technology wasn't like it is today.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a little different world. I've got a few things from high school that are still floating around that I can get to. Of course, my dad was the guy that had the old giant camcorder and was filming stuff. So I still got a few things. Then he converted them to for me a couple of years ago. He converted them to DVD. So I've got one or two things that I've looked at in the semi-recent past, but most of that stuff is just, again, lost to history. So when you think about your own recruitment and your process for choosing a college and how you end up at the University at Albany, just tell me a little bit about what that was like and what you remember. Because again, completely different era where there wasn't a whole lot of information out there for people. And I think a lot of kids, especially if you didn't have a high school coach or parents who had kind of gone through the process before, it was easy to kind of be flying in the dark. So what do you remember about that process for you?
Well, again, my process was short and simple. I visited one school and it was Albany. One of my former teammates was on the team there, and I had gotten a letter from the assistant coach recruiting me, and I just went up to visit in March before September, which would have been my freshman year. I had a great time, and I ended up going there. Like, you know, I had received a lot of letters from Drew University, from Brandeis, from NYU, from a bunch of different schools, but the recruiting process was a lot different. And I was just lucky to go to a place like Albany where it was a good fit for me academically and socially, and it worked out well. And I just got lucky. Neither one of my parents had gone to school, and they were not part of the process. You know, for example, like my son is a high school senior. He's taking a gap year. He's a tennis player. And he and I, we went on college tours, and we went to 12 different universities to take a look at it. You know, that was not the case for me. And I was just very fortunate and lucky to be in a situation where I had a former teammate that was at a place that I had gone to visit and I absolutely fell in love with. And, you know, it's funny, like I still have a number of guys, that high school teammate and I are still in communication, but there's about, you know, 15 guys that I graduated with. And we go camping every year, and we have for like the last 35, 40 years, we go every Memorial Day weekend. And it's just kind of like part of the thing that we do. Is luckily I was doing it before I got married. So it was,
you're grandfathered in.
I'm grandfathered in, as well as my buddies, that is never a question on what I'm doing Memorial Day weekend, because I'm going to hang out with my boys.
That's funny. That's good stuff. Going into school, obviously with the caliber of schools that you're looking at, you were a good student. What were you thinking about in terms of career wise?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I use this all the time when I'm recruiting kids. Like, I ask kids the same question. I tell me the three things you think about the most through the course of your day. And I tell them, don't think about what you think I want. Don't tell me what you think I want to hear. Don't tell me you're thinking about physics or school, because it's not on the list. And I have on my index card in my office, I write three things: girls, family, God. That's all on one line. Food and basketball. So when I was 18 years old, all I thought about was what I was having for dinner, what girl I was going to date, and when I was going to hoop again. And that was the only thing going through my little pea brain at the time. And not thinking about a career and what you want to do for the rest of your life really wasn't a great thought. And so if you would have asked me that when I was 18, I would have said business. But honestly, I didn't know what that meant. Like, yeah, I could have been in marketing and finance and, you know, and accounting. So there's all these different things that you can do in business. But I just said that as a grander scheme, because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had three different majors. I started out majoring in business, and then I went to criminal justice, and I ended in communication. So you know, as a young man, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I had a gift of gab. I could talk to people. And I got into sales right out of college because of that. But in terms of a direction and understanding it, didn't know. My dad was a laborer. He was a presser in dry cleaners. And I went to work with him most every day in the summertime and on the weekends to make money. And I enjoyed being around my dad. And all I knew is that I didn't want to be a presser for the rest of my life.
Coaching at this point, not on your radar at all.
No, it was not. It was never something that I thought that I wanted to do or you know, felt like it is something I could do. Like, it just wasn't part of who I was. And I just got very lucky even getting into coaching. And again, I've said it several times already. I'm a very fortunate and lucky person to have the opportunities that I have. And I kind of lucked into a lot of different things.
Because you were out of the game for what, like 5 years, right?
Yeah. So I graduated from college and I got a job at selling, which was really equipped for who I am. Like, you know, I could certainly get out and talk to people. And I always felt like I could sell snow to an Eskimo. It's kind of like, you know, that's kind of like part of what recruiting is. It's like you're selling the university that you coach at, and you're selling yourself and what you think you're able to do. So I've never had a problem with speaking about myself or speaking about a place that I love as I do Yale University. So I went to work for NCR. I sold computer products for 5 years, and I was dating a young lady who had a girlfriend whose sister knew the assistant women's coach at Albany, where I went to school. And we went up to Travers Racetrack, Saratoga Racetrack for Travers. And she told me that my former head coach was looking for an assistant, and I had grown tired of selling. And, you know, I called him up and asked him if the position was open. And he said, well, he's not sure, but if it is, he'd give me a call back. Called me back 2 weeks later and told me to come up and meet with the AD. And I had gone back to school, and the plan was to – I had gone into coaching, and the plan was to coach and get an MBA and then go work on Wall Street because a lot of money was being made at the time. But I ended up falling in love and gotten snake bit with basketball, and I haven't worked a day since.
What was it about coaching, that first experience, the first couple of weeks, the first couple of months? What was it that really grabbed you?
Well, my first team, we were 17-3, and I thought coaching was easy, right? You know, because I had better players than the teams that we played against. I was a head JV coach, assistant varsity coach, so I thought coaching was easy. And I think what captivated me the most, and it still does, is the relationships you have with the young men that you coach. Now, at that point, I didn't realize what it would grow into. And this is morphed into something that I couldn't imagine at the time that I got into coaching. You know, every Christmas, and I was speaking to one of my alums 2 days ago, Dan Aconquil. He had graduated when I was an assistant coach here at Yale. And he sent me a Christmas card. And I said, listen, tell your wife not to stop sending the Christmas cards, because I love to see the young men that I coached and their family and the growth of them, and how many times I've become sort of a grandfather, so to speak, with this extended family I have in coaching. And that's what truly makes coaching special, are the relationships that you have with the young men that you coach, especially when they graduate. You know, certainly you want to win championships, and that makes things a little bit more special. But those relationships and what you've built and how they're connected through basketball and through what you built, that's what makes it special.
How long into your career were you before you realized that that was really where the magic was?
That's a great question. I'd say I was probably as a head coach when I got to this part of it. And then as a head coach 4 years in, when I had my first group of graduates. And then what you understand is, like, now these guys are going away. They're going to leave the university, but you still stay connected to them, and you still want to stay connected to them. But you miss them at the same time. And now I've kind of got long in the tooth that the guys that graduate from Yale now, I may see 3 or 4 more times the rest of my life once they graduate. And that's just kind of weird to think about. Like, I'm 59 years old, and, you know, they may come back for a game. They may see us on a road for a game. They may come back for a reunion. I may see them at a wedding. But, you know, I'm going to see these guys 3-4 more times the rest of my life. And then that's kind of scary to think about, because I do think of these young men as part of my family and my extended children.
Well, it's crazy when you consider how much time you spend together over the course of their 4 years on campus. And then you think, okay, all that time we're spending on a day-to-day, especially with the rules the way they are today and guys being on campus all summer. And again, completely different from the time when you played or when I played, where it was just, you kind of went your own way in the summertime. And obviously now completely different, but yeah, to think about, hey, I might only see these guys that I've spent basically four of the most influential years of their lives, right? Where those guys are transforming from boys to into young men, and you're getting them prepared for what they're going to do for the rest of their life. And you've had that impact. And I think to be able to always think that, yeah, maybe I'm only going to see them three or four times, but to be able to have that connection again, really, that's what makes coaching basketball special, is you love the game and the fact that you can use the game to build those kind of relationships and have the kind of impact on kids that you're talking about. To me, that's really what coaching ends up being all about, is, you know, all that other stuff, like you mentioned, winning and championships and all that stuff. Clearly it's important. And on the college level, you got to do that in order to be able to keep your job. But ultimately it's the impact that you're having through the game. I think that really gives most coaches the satisfaction that they're looking for, because they know they're having an impact on young lives.
Yep. 100%.
All right. So talk to me a little bit about your experiences as an assistant coach, both at Albany, and I know you were here in Ohio at OU. What did you learn as an assistant that you feel like were great lessons that helped you when you eventually got a head coaching job?
Well, first of all, you learn a lot about what not to do. You learn a lot about, you know, different ways of doing things. And you learn how you want to be treated as an assistant coach and how you would treat people in your stead. So, you know, you think about years ago, you know, there are a lot of head coaches that thought about assistants as, you know, guys that you can utilize at your personal whim. Like, I know guys that have been asked to pick up dry cleaning and drive to the airport and pick up extended families and, you know, crazy things like that I would never ask any of my assistants to do. Like, the only way you're going to go pick up my dry cleaning is this, like, I'm in a shower and I forgot my shirt and I can't get out, and like, please help me out. There's no way I would have anybody that works for me do anything like that personally. So you learn a lot about what not to do. And then I learned about a lot of that, what I don't know, right? Like, it's funny. This is a great story. I'm at Albany and I'm working with Doc Sowers, winningest coach in Division III history. And I'm with him and he goes, hey, let's go up the road. There's this guy, Beeline. He's going to be at this Holiday Inn in Rochester, and he's giving a basketball clinic. And I'm like, the last thing I want to do is drive with you, you know, 3 hours one way, because I'm doing all the driving, right? We're going to drive 3 hours one way and 3 hours back to listen to some Joe Schmo Beeline talk about basketball. I remember going and sitting down. They had one of those projectors I can't remember what they're called, where you had those clear sheets. And
the overhead projector. Overhead
projector.
Oh, yeah.
So he's got an overhead projector, and he's writing all this stuff down. And I couldn't stop copying what he was writing down because I didn't know any of it. And because the only knowledge I had of real basketball was – what I had learned from Doc as a player and as a, as assistant coach. So it was very limited in terms of what I knew. So I learned a lot about what I didn't know. And so at that point, I started a binder of all the things that I found interesting or that I liked when I was scouting different teams. And I would just add stuff, different plays, different schematics. I also started thinking about the best way to formulate my team practice-wise. So I kept all the practice plans from the different years when I was an assistant coach. So there's all these things that you do to try to prepare yourself to be a head coach. And I remember thinking to myself, I got into coaching a little bit later. I was like, I think 28 or so when I first got into coaching, without doing the math. You know, I wanted to get a head job by the time I was 40. And fortunately enough for me, I was a head coach by the time I was 36. So I kind of outkicked that coverage of getting there a little earlier than I thought I might. And at that young age, I was just full of piss and vinegar. And I was, you know, kind of learning on a job in some respects. And, you know, but that all that cutting my teeth as a head coach helped me be who I am today.
When you think back to taking over as the head coach for the first time, and you go from being that assistant where the saying is always right, as an assistant coach, you just give suggestions, and as a head coach, you got to make decisions. What was that transition like in terms of going from, hey, I'm kind of in the background and I can suggest some stuff, to, hey, ultimately the buck's stopping at my desk now and I got to make these decisions? How much did you enjoy that process? I don't know if enjoy is the right word, but how much did you enjoy getting the opportunity to kind of put your stamp on, hey, now I can make this ultimate decision about how I'm going to build the program?
Well, number one, my transition was seamless because I grew up with a father who had given me enough self-respect and enough self-love to believe in myself. And I did, and I do. And, you know, I trust me a lot. I like me a lot. And as an assistant coach, I remember working for Doc Sowers. And, you know, as an assistant, young assistant, you know, you got all these ideas. I remember being in his office once and we're going over whatever we're going over. And I'm like, yeah, coach, we can do this and we can do this and we can do that. We can, like, and I'm going crazy throwing all this stuff out on him. And then all of a sudden he goes, James, listen, when you get your own freaking team, you can do whatever you want. But right now we're doing what I freaking want to do. And like, and at that point it caught me. And that's when I really realized I was an assistant coach, and that you have this inner voice that grows as an assistant. And that voice is telling you that you want to be a head coach. And my voice, inner voice, started getting louder and louder. And I knew I was ready to become a head coach when Larry Hunter, when I was at Ohio University, started using a lot of my suggestions. So if we're sitting in office and I'm suggesting stuff and that's the stuff that's being implemented, I knew at that time that I was ready to take over. And, you know, there were still things you wanted to learn to do. It wasn't not so much basketball, but from what I believe the most important thing in coaching is your ability to manage people. You know, we all know X's and O's. Like, you know, no one knows more basketball than I do that you're going to beat me because you know more basketball. I believe it's how you manage your locker room that makes difference in terms of how successful you are or not.
What does that look like when you think about managing a locker room? What goes into that in your thought process?
Well, I think the first thing that you have to do is you have to close your eyes and you have to know what it looks like. Like, you have to know what it looks like or what you're trying to accomplish when you close your eyes. And I certainly do. And then you have to have a pulse on your locker room. You have to know the kids that you recruited, and you have to understand and foresee problems before they crop up. For example, we have four starters back, and they all want more. But if you think about it, Cornell played with the quickest pace in our league. They only took four more shots a game than we did. So if we play at a higher pace, a quicker pace, and we will, well, you can maybe get four more shots a game. Well, that's one more shot a guy. And that's not even counting the fifth guy who does that. So my thing to my team is that you have to be more efficient. So that's what, when they left campus last year, that was the message that they heard. When they got back to campus for us to go to play in Greece, that was the message that they heard. When we get in the locker room on next Wednesday for the first time, that will be the message that they hear. And then managing the expectations of the guys on my team. I'm going to have 17 guys on my roster without a bad player. We have no bad players. Every single guy on my team could help us win, especially in the right situation. Every single guy on my team would be in a rotation on at least one other team, but they won't be in a rotation on our team. So with that being said, my ability to manage our expectations is going to mean the difference in us being successful or not. So me understanding that, and our coaching staff understanding that, that's what helps us. And that's what understanding and then managing your team means to me, is knowing what you have to do with these guys in each and every year, and being able to close your eyes and see what it's going to look like in on and off the court.
What does that look like with the guys who, as you get into the season, they're not playing as much as they want to? How do you keep those guys engaged? What do you do to make sure that they know that you're still investing in them as a player, as a person, even though they're not getting the minutes that they'd like to see? Because obviously we know, look, kids who are towards the end of your bench that aren't playing as much as they want to, it's easy for those kids to start to wonder and question and try to figure things out. So what do you do to make sure that you keep those guys engaged and you let them know, hey, I care about you as a player, as a person, and you're a big part of what we're doing?
Well, again, it's the conversations they have with the guys on the team. And, like, you know, we stat every practice. So, you know, you could be really good, but you're not better than the guys in front of you. So you can want – we all want things. Like, you know, I want to win the lottery for $500 million, right? We all want things. But the reality of it is – and everybody has to be able to look in the mirror – at themselves in terms of who they are and understand that. So it's my job to make sure they see a clear path to why they're in a situation that they're in. I have to make sure that I draw that picture for them so they can see it and understand it. And if you can do that, then they can believe you. Like, I've been a head coach at Yale for 25 years. I have never had one kid transfer. Not one time has a kid knocked on my door and said, hey, coach, this isn't what you said it was going to be. I'm not happy here. I want to transfer. And I think a lot of that is because we bet the right people. But while they're at our university, we make sure they understand what they need to do to be successful. And they get to go to practice every day to prove that. And they're either going to do it or not. And, you know, it's on them, and they have to understand that. Now, that's a life lesson that everybody needs to learn. We all need life lessons.
All right. Talk a little bit about the recruiting process that you guys go through. Because obviously with that track record of guys not transferring, so much of that is a credit to what you do once they're there, but it's also a credit to the kind of kid that you're bringing into your program and how much you get to know them through that recruiting process. So maybe start at the very beginning. How do you guys identify the list of kids? Because clearly in the Ivy League at Yale, you guys have a different set of academic standards than most of the schools that you're potentially competing with for recruits. So just talk about how you get your list initially and then walk me through the process of kind of start to finish of recruiting a kid.
Well, listen, I am fortunate to have the best staff in the league. You know, my staff is tremendous. They do a great job. And I don't really have to tell them to do anything. Coach Kingsley's been with me for 15 years. Coach Simon played for me. He's been with me for 11, 12 years. So, you know, they know, you know, exactly what needs to be done. My director of basketball operations, Matt Elkins, been with me for 3 years now. So I don't ever have to ask them to do anything. I don't, because they're already three steps ahead of me. So that being said, that's where it starts. And, you know, around the country, we know certain places or certain areas that are going to be good for us to recruit. So, and their coaches that we know are, whether it be high school or prep school or AAU, we know certain guys are always going to have kids. So you just make phone calls, you reach out, you touch people, you have those relationships. And now once you identify a kid who's good enough for you, well, then you also got to make sure they're good enough academically. And then you have to make sure it's going to work out financially. And then once you cross those hurdles, because the only hurdle you really want to have at the end of the day is if the kid likes you. So we like him. It's going to work out academically. It's going to work out financially. Now the last hurdle is they got to like us. So, you know, a lot of phone calls, a lot of text messages, visits that go on. We go out and evaluate these guys to make sure that we vet them correctly. But a lot of the recruiting that we do is just going to go watch them play so they know that we care. And then we're not evaluating them anymore. We're just letting them know that, hey, listen, Yale is here, and we want to make sure that you know that. And when it comes at the end of the day, we want to feel like we've put more time and energy to you than the other coaches that may be recruiting you, which really helps.
And during that evaluation process, how do you weigh out watching a kid with their high school team versus watching them in an AAU setting? Do you prefer one or the other? Are you looking for different things when you're seeing them in different settings? Does it matter? How do you approach that piece of it?
Well, I think we approach it by understanding what it is. Like, there are times, like, Justin Sears, who's a two-time player of the year in the Ivy League. I went to watch him play in his high school, and he was really good, played well. I went to watch him play in his with his AAU program. He had 9 turnovers in the first half of a game. 9. Right? So, you know, you just got to, like, understand that every time you go watch kids play, they're not going to be at their best. And but you, there's certain things you want to see, whether it be athleticism or skill. You want to see if those kids have those aspects of something that's going to help them be successful within your program. Like the way we play, our guards have to dribble, pass, and shoot, and that's real easy. But to think about it, because everybody likes guys that can dribble, pass, and shoot. So we're looking for certain things of that nature. And the main thing we're looking for when it starts is for toughness. You know, if you're not tough, well, it's hard to be any good, because if the ball's lying on the ground and it's loose, you're going to watch it. And if you're going to watch it, your team's going to lose. So we're looking for kids that have a toughness, and we're looking for kids that have a certain skill level. Once we get to that part, you know, talking to AAU coaches and high school coaches and parents to try to get them all on board with who we are and what we're trying to do. And to be honest with you, you know, parents and family members and teachers, those are some of our best recruiters, because when we're not there, those are the people talking in the kid's ear, telling them that, listen, this is a life-changing opportunity for you, and you really need to take a good hard look at it. And, you know, that's what we're trying to get our kids to understand, is the difference of what a Yale education can do for you for the next 40 years of your life, not just the next 4.
No, it makes complete sense. And I think that when you start talking about kids that have that opportunity, clearly it's not an opportunity that everybody gets with the grades that you have to have as a high school player, and the test scores and all the things that go into it. And then just, again, making sure that those people are a good fit for what happens at Yale. And then, as you said, it sets them up for not just those 4 years they're at Yale, but for the rest of their entirety of their life. What's your philosophy in terms of how you like to set up practice? Do you have the same format day in and day out? Do you like to mix it up? Just how do you design your practices? How do you think about practice design?
Well, it starts with defense for me. You know, we have 3 areas in which we try to be really good at. We want to rebound, we want to defend, and we want to share the ball. So our practices are based on areas around those things. And my assistants have softened me up over the years. I remember when I first started coaching at Yale, we might not take a shot in practice for the first, you know, week or so, where it's all about defense and rebounding and trying to build a base for that. You know, we played over here in Greece, and what I realize now is that our offense is much further ahead of our defense. And there are things, all those drills that we do, all the rotations that we have, all the different reps that guys get, that's what really makes a difference for us. And we got to make sure that we get back to that when practice starts. But, you know, trying to organize practice and keep it fun, keep it where guys are going to be mentally into it. Everything in our practices, you know, every drill that we do has a minute attached to it. Where, so this drill, we may loosen up for 10 minutes, and then we may run some transition stuff for 4 minutes, and then we may shoot for 5, and then we may do dummy offense for 10, and then we may offensive execute for 15, and then we may shoot again. So everything has a minute base on it, where I try to keep on task that way, to try to get us ready to play, you know, building it up from scratch from the bottom. And, you know, we'll start with our shell, and we'll just work on passing the ball and jumping and playing in gaps and moving from side to side. And then we'll work on guarding cuts, and then we'll work on different screening action, all within our 4-on-4 shell, till we build it up to play 5-on-5. So, you know, we get 6 weeks or so to build our team up before our first game. And, you know, it always seems like you never have enough time to get it all in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's universal amongst coaches.
Hey, Hoopheads Nation, whether you're a beginner basketball player looking for a place to start or a seasoned vet looking to level up your skills, I want to tell you about your new go-to secret weapon. It's called Train. Train is a basketball training and education platform that gives you on-demand access to premium basketball courses created by expert coaches and trainers from around the world. Want to get better at blowing by your defender? Learn setup drills with NBA and international pro trainer Marius Williams, or how to use the punch drag with NBA trainer Kerry Darting. Looking to level up your catch-and-shoot skills? Practice space shooting workouts with former lead female trainer for Kobe Bryant's Mamba League, San Dixon. Or if you're just starting out, learn the basics of shooting and finishing at the basket from international champion, three-time Romanian Player of the Year, and Train co-founder, Vlad Moldovanu. Train has 32 and counting actionable, expert-led, on-demand basketball training courses that teach you exactly how to improve your ball handling, shooting, attacking, and more. For a limited time, Hoopheads listeners get 35% off monthly, annual, and lifetime plans. Just go to gotrainbasketball.com/hoopheads to learn more and sign up for a free 7-day trial.
How do you think about putting together the groups that play together in practice? In other words, if you have, let's say, your guy who's your seventh man on your depth chart, how do you make sure that that guy gets minutes with the guys who may be starters so that you kind of mix together those lineups? Do you vary that up practice by practice? Do you vary it up within the practice itself? How do you just make sure that you're dividing and balancing out the teams and the groups in practice to make sure everybody gets a chance to play with everybody else so that when they step on the floor in a game that they've had enough time to build that chemistry that you're looking for?
Well, it's a slow build. We want to, mix guys up, especially when we start our practices and have an open season where, we're really working to give everybody a chance. So, I may have in my mind who the starting lineup should be to start the first practice, but we won't see them together fully until they all prove that they deserve it through practice against everybody else. So we'll just mix guys up together. And like I said before, I'm fortunate that we don't have any bad players. So, we can mix guys in and there. And then we try to, there's certain days that, okay, I want to see these two guys play together, or I want to see these two guys play against each other. It's just a matter of, how the season's going along and how we build it to try to figure out, who should be playing with whom and at what time.
I'm assuming that you already said that you stat everything in practice. I'm assuming that you're filming practice, correct?
Yeah, we are fortunate to have Key Motion. And Key Motion, we can actually, we have it set up in our practice facility and also our game facility where we're able to watch every single thing that we do. We send guys tape after practice. If somebody says, "Oh, I didn't foul that guy," I can, it's real time. I can go, "Whoa, let's take a look at this. You did foul a guy." Because I don't know about you, but no one's ever committed a foul in practice. Ever.
That's good. I love that. All right. When did you start having the capability to film practice, and how valuable has that been as a tool compared to when you couldn't do it?
Well, there were times where we would film practice occasionally. But now that we have the setup with Key Motion, it's just like you punch the time into a iPad and boom, you're done. You got it. So that Key Motion's probably been about 6 years now that we've had it. And it's just been an invaluable tool for our program, trying to make sure that we can, learn through film.
How much time do your players spend watching film? In other words, when you do a breakdown, if you're sending a kid something individually to him or with the entire team, just how much time do you spend with the team going over film sessions, as opposed to obviously you and your coaching staff spending a lot more time than what you're sharing with the players? But what do you share with the players? Because I know sometimes coaches talk about, hey, so different teams are different, or this guy needs more, this guy needs less. How do you think about how much you share with the players?
Well, I think that anytime you could give a learning situation, because, people learn different ways. Some guys learn verbally. Some guys learn by doing. Some guys learn by seeing. So you need to have a good mix of all three to try to find out what's the best way for your kids to learn. The best thing about film is film don't lie, right? Like I talked about with the guy who says he didn't foul anybody. The film doesn't lie. So it helps you understand exactly who you are and what you need to do. So, we make sure that we have a, a good mix of that. My assistant coaches, going back to that point I made to you before, they all of a sudden I'll say, hey, Matt, why don't you take the guards and work on that our weak side help and show them some clips of what we're not doing. He goes, Coach, I already did that. This tape's already set. I'm watching it with the guards tomorrow before practice. So we'll have guard sessions that we do. Coach Simon will have post sessions that we'll do. And then, you know, I'll have overall stuff that I'll show to the team before practice. We got a film room. And, you know, we only do like, you know, 10 minutes of it, 15 minutes of it, depending on the day. And depending on, like, if we need a cerebral day to get guys off their feet, we may watch a little bit more. And we certainly watch after each and every game, we'll watch film breakdown of what we didn't do, even in a win. Like, we want to show, okay, we're not blocking guys out, or we're not getting back on defense, or we're not closing out with our hands high enough. Whatever the case may be, we try to work on that film so guys can see themselves, because it's one thing for someone to tell you, for some kids, that you're not closing out the right way. It's another thing for you to see it.
Do you think about the balance between showing them, hey, here's something that we're doing incorrectly that we need to fix, versus showing them stuff that, hey, here's where we did exactly what we're looking for? How do you balance those positive and negative clips? Is that something that you think about?
Oh, no doubt. I think that, you know, each time that I show them some negative, I want to show them some positive too. I want to give them some positive reinforcement and make them feel good about who they are and what we're trying to do.
All right. You mentioned your assistants a couple times and just the different things that they do. How do you think about the delegation piece of your job as a head coach? How do you figure out which guy is going to do what, and how do you make sure you're maximizing each one of your staff strengths?
Well, I think that's the easy part of the job. I've been able to delegate a lot more over the years as I've grown comfortable with my staff. And I think that I want all my guys to have a hand in everything that we do. I want to make sure they're well-rounded. So when they leave Yale and they go to become a head coach on their own, they're ready to do so. They're ready because they've already done it in practice, and they've already done it for me. So I really make sure that all my guys have a foot in our offense, or a hand in our offense and a hand in our defense, and understanding what we're doing with recruiting, because again, and that helps my guys be vested. And I think that's important. Just like you want your players vested, you want your staff vested as well. And Bill Parcells said something really interesting that, Bill Belichick said this, is that you don't want to have to coach your coaches. If you have to do that, then you got something wrong. And I certainly don't have to coach my coaches, because they're, like I said, always a step ahead of me and ready to do what we need to do to be successful.
When you think about the totality of your program and you think about the leadership that you provide as the head of the program, and obviously you're looking for your coaching staff to be those leaders, I think one of the things that, when I think about what makes a basketball team or a basketball program successful, I think about teams that have leaders amongst the players, and every player feels like they have a spot where they can lead. But clearly, if you have guys who are the leaders, the guys that everybody's looks to, how do you think about developing the leaders on your team? And what are some things that you do to give your players an opportunity and give them space to lead?
Well, I think that, you know, you want to make sure that your senior leaders are coveted, that you know, guys want to be like them. And to do so, that you have to give them responsibility. So, you know, I think it's important to ask your players, like, we have a donor that has given us $100,000 for each of the last 7 or 8 years for projects to make Yale basketball better. And, you know, he's done so much, it's like, there's not a lot that we can do that with $100,000. I mean, obviously that's not a small number, but it's not like if I wanted to build a wellness center, I need $4 million. That's right. Not going to get done. So in any event, just asking your players what it is that you think we need, where should we go to dinner, like giving them opportunities to answer questions and to help your program, I think are really important, because the younger guys, the freshmen and the sophomores, you know, they'll want to become leaders as well, and understand it'll be their chance to say where they're going to go eat dinner or what they're going to do and how they're going to do it.
Big picture question for you here. So you've been at Yale for 25 years. Obviously, the success that you had speaks for itself, and the institution, Yale University, and the pedigree and the brand that goes along with that makes it super special. But I'm sure over the years that there's been other places that have come calling and have knocked on your door and maybe talked to you about, hey, we have another opportunity that may be different from the one that you have now. Why stay at Yale? What makes it so special? Just when you think about the institution and the program and the totality of your 25 years, when you think about that, what makes Yale University and Ivy League basketball so special in your mind?
Well, number one, I've not been offered an opportunity better than Yale. I think that that's a big part of it. I haven't had an opportunity where you would say that job is better than the one I have. Where Yale basketball is and what we've been able to do, you know, it's hard to get a better opportunity than the one I have. And the reason why you stay here is because, you know, we do things the right way. There are a lot of things that are going on in college basketball right now that that don't affect us. Like, we're not affected by the transfer portal. We're not affected by NIL, not yet anyway. So, you know, I just have a different peace of mind when I put my head down on my pillow at night, knowing that I have a group of men that are special people and that I'm not having to worry about them and their decisions that they make.
What's been the biggest change that you've seen over your 25 years in terms of whether it's the game itself, the players, are they the same? Are they different? What do you think about when you think about the biggest changes over the course of your career?
Well, the biggest changes have just occurred, right? With this NIL, this has been really a game changer where, you know, in the past, you know, people would do things under the table for players, and now it's out there for everybody to know that this player is getting $400,000 to play, or this player is getting $1 million to play. You know, that's a whole different world now. That's different now. And you know, outside of that, you know, it's similar to what it was 20 years ago. The players are similar to who they were 20 years ago. You know, it's a great game, and I wake up every day anxious to get to my job and ready to work with my guys. So I haven't seen a lot that's changed outside of the different rules that we've had here the last few years.
What about the game itself and the style of play and the way the game is played? When you think about the advent and emphasis in the last 5 or 10 years on the three-point shot, you think about how much the ball screen has become so much more important. Whereas when I think back to the era when I was playing from 88 to 92, when you had so much motion offense and off ball screening, and just, it's a different, the game has evolved in a different way. How do you think about some of the changes that have occurred on the floor in terms of style of play and just the way that the game has changed?
Well, you know, Steph Curry changed the game, right? You know, like the 3-point shot is just, everybody shoots it now. Just like everybody dunks, everybody shoots a three now.
Yep.
And that has changed the game, where you used to have it where you had you could play big lineups and back to the basket guys. You look at the NBA, a guy like Shaq talks about it all the time, is that, you know, because of him, there were like, you know, probably 10 guys in the NBA that wouldn't have been there because they needed somebody to guard Shaq, right? So there were these big body guys they have. Like, the big body guys, they just don't have those guys in NBA anymore unless you're skilled or you have one great aspect of your job where you're a great rebounder, a great defensive player. If you're not one of those guys, it's hard to get there as a big guy these days. And, you know, and then you have all these guys that are just like long and lean and athletic. And really, like, you know, a Kevin Durant that's, you know, almost 7 feet tall, and he has skills like a two guard. So the different kind of players in the NBA have changed, and especially along the lines of the Europeans. You know, they've come and they, like Giannis and Joker and Luka Doncic, like all these guys have kind of changed the way that game is played. And in college, I see it more of a five out schematic going on now, where people are spreading the floor a little bit more because of the 3-point shot. Those are the major differences that I see.
Skill level of players today higher than the skill level of players in the past, in your opinion, or no?
Well, you know, that's really tough to quantify. I mean, you know, they had guys like Pearl Washington. Like, who was more skilled with a ball than Pearl Washington now? Could anybody handle a ball as well as that kid handled it back when he played for Syracuse? I'm not sure. So I think maybe the overall skill level is better. I think what our post players do specifically, their skill level is a lot better. I think the guard play may be similar, but as I said, the ability to shoot the three and shoot it from deep is just different. You know, like there was a time where, you know, my coaches in college, we didn't even have a 3-point line until my junior year in college. Right? There was no 3-point line. And then it was the ACC line, but in between the top of the key and the foul line, which was basically a layup for a lot of guys. And then now it's moved out and moved back. And, you know, we'll see if it ever gets to the European style of play when we go to quarters and have a different lane.
Do you see that happening ever?
You know, I hope not. I don't like change that much. I got to admit, I'm an old head. I kind of like the way things were or the way things are.
Yeah. I mean, I think when you start looking at it would be hard to imagine. When I think of college basketball, I just think of the 20 minute half going to a 10 minute quarter. It just would seem like, hey, it's the third quarter. That just would seem weird when you start talking about college basketball.
The main thing that changes is the free throw shooting.
Right.
So now, like, you got to get to five, and before you get to the free throw line, and then it's two shots, and it's not a one and one. So it's all that stuff, I think, too, that makes a difference that will change the game somewhat.
Well, here in the state of Ohio, we're going in high school this year. They're doing away with the one and one. The one and one is gone, and it's all
right.
Yeah, everything is going to two shots. So if I'm not mistaken, I think. Because we play the 8-minute quarters, and I think what's going to happen is they might be doing the fouls by half, but I know they're doing away this year with the one and one, which to me, I don't know. Again, just to echo what you said, I feel like going back in old school. Like I just can't imagine there being a situation where, you know, you're trying to come back and whatever, you're getting the guy to a line and got to make that one on one, man. You got to make the front end, and to have that go away is just one of those things. I'm not a fan of that change. Let's put it that way.
Well, that makes two of us. I'm definitely not a fan of taking away the one on one, the pressure. And again, I think that, you know, you look at that and it just makes it changes who you are as a player. And I'd rather have the pressure than not.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's any question about that. I know as I was preparing for our pod tonight that one of the things that is on your mind a lot as an African-American coach is getting opportunities for other African-American coaches to be able to coach at the highest level in Division I college basketball. You've obviously had, again, a tremendous amount of success. You've been at Yale for 25 years, and you set the bar pretty high. What do you think about in terms of trying to help younger African-American coaches get opportunities in the game? What do you see as things that need to be done in order to improve that situation?
Well, you know, that's a great question, what needs to be done. I just think that flat out, like you said, it just needs to be an opportunity. And you know, if you did some research and tried to figure out, you know, how many African-American coaches there are in a game, and then how long of an opportunity do they have to be successful or not as opposed to their white counterparts. You know, it's amazing, you know, the differences that go on in college basketball and the different degrees in which we're given opportunity, especially given the complexion of the average college player. So, it's a shame that this is the way it is and that, you know, guys aren't given an opportunity. And, you know, there have been peaks and valleys with it. I mean, there once was a time where there are 6 out of 8 coaches in the Ivy League were African American. But, it, you know, it's not something that was sustained and didn't last. And I just hope that, you know, more often than not, that some guys are given the benefit of that doubt and given the opportunity to try to run some of these teams and trying to be successful, and especially at the highest levels. I mean, I think that's where we have a misnomer. I think for me, as a Black man, seeing John Thompson and John Chaney and Nolan Richardson play at the highest level and get to Sweet 16s, Final Fours, and win national championships, that gave me the inkling that this is something I could be successful at, because they did it and they kind of looked like me. We all need to have those kind of role models, and we need to have those kind of people that we can look up to, and those kind of people that we feel like we can emulate. And if you look around college basketball right now, there's not a African American in the Pac-12. I don't believe any of it. Well, the former Pac-12. I don't know what's going to.
Who knows what that league even is anymore? The college conference landscape is insane.
Yeah, because it's all about money. But if you look at all the best jobs in the country, how many of those jobs are given to African Americans? Just not very many of them. They're just not. And then, like I said, and once you get those opportunities, how long do you have before they let you go? Like, there were 2 African American coaches that got let go after 1 year. Desmond Oliver was let go at East Tennessee State after 1 year. I mean, it's like, I'm just not getting how this is supposed to work.
Yeah, it's crazy. I know that Dwayne Killings at your alma mater, when we talked to him, we did a series of podcasts with Dwayne his first year at Albany, and he talked a lot about just how, one, he was grateful for the opportunity, but two, that he really felt, and I don't know if pressure is the right word, but he just felt, I think responsibility is probably a better word. He felt a responsibility that, you know, I have to be successful in this job, not just for me, but I have to be successful so the next guy gets an opportunity. Because if I can have success and I can do this and I can get it done, then that's going to give the next guy a better chance. Whereas if things don't work out, now, boom, all of a sudden, here's another excuse, here's another reason, here's another example, like the couple that you just cited, where a guy gets a job. Now, if you don't have that success, suddenly the next guy behind you maybe doesn't get that opportunity. I just thought it was interesting to hear Dwayne talk about that responsibility that he felt, again, not just for himself, but for the guys that were coming after him. And again, I don't think that's something that the average college basketball fan, I don't think people are thinking about that stuff. I really don't.
No, I think you're right. I don't think it's certainly not thought about enough. And I think it's why we have the problems that we have with the numbers that we have, especially at the highest level.
What do you think are the solutions? I mean, clearly, one solution, right, is to have more African Americans in decision making positions.
Yep.
Within the university system, so we need more African American ADs and college presidents and people that are seeing the value there, and we just don't have that. And then I think the second piece is, how do you continue when you have this lack of opportunity? How do you continue to encourage and develop that pipeline of great coaches coming up through the ranks so that when these jobs do open up, that you have guys who are ready and able to step in? To me, those are two things that I think are really important when we start talking about starting to be able to even the playing field to some degree.
Well, again, like, so if you look at it from the athletic director standpoint, it's like we all are prejudiced to a certain extent, meaning that you want to hire people that look like you or that you feel comfortable with. And it's not something that some people don't do it, you know, knowingly. There's just a comfort level. I'm more comfortable with this guy because he looks like me. So until there are more ADs and there are more vice presidents and more presidents, you know, it's hard to get there unless you make an active decision to hire somebody that doesn't look like you. You know, we have to make that decision going into it, because if you don't make that decision going into it, you're never going to get there. You're just never going to get there. And so I think that that's that's what has to happen, is that there have to be these active decisions made prior to the hire, that we want to make sure that we give a person of color an opportunity to be good.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge that's out there for the college basketball landscape, and trying to make sure that guys who are ready and guys who have the opportunity to be successful get that opportunity. Because it just feels like, again, when you start talking about what the makeup of the coaching landscape looks like and who gets those jobs, it just feels like there's an opportunity that is being missed. And when you start talking about developing coaching talent and guys getting overlooked and not getting the opportunities that they deserve, and nobody wants to see that in any walk of life. We want to be able to see the people who are ready and the people who are capable get those jobs. And I think that's something that, again, everybody in the coaching profession has to continue to try to work towards and push towards. And I think if we can continue to make people aware, and hopefully that at some point we can get that turned around. Tell me a little bit about your experiences with USA Basketball. I know you've had an opportunity to work with USA Basketball in a couple of different capacities. How does that opportunity come to you? And then what were your experiences like with USA Basketball?
Well, Sean Ford was a Villanova guy, and my brother was coached at Villanova for a bit. And I got into USA Basketball initially because Jim Boeheim and my former boss, Dick Sowers, they were some golfing buddies. Like, they used to coach – Doc used to coach golf at Yale, and I think Jim Boeheim coached golf at Syracuse, and they would have tournaments against each other or see each other at tournaments. And, you know, a lot of basketball coaches play some golf in the off season. So they became friends, and I wrote Jim Boeheim a letter asking him to be part of USA Basketball. And I was asked to be a court coach way back in the early 2000s. And then I went with Mark Gottfried and Jay Wright to Brazil to play in the Pan American Games. Brilliant opportunity, wonderful to be part of it. I was with the 19 and under national team that went to Latvia a few years ago. And out of the 12 guys on that team, I think 9 of them are in the NBA right now, which is a tremendous team. We won the gold medal against the kid from France who's got drafted by the Spurs. So, you know, there's some great opportunities there to see these young men grow up and watch them in their careers. It's truly amazing to take a look and see how it goes and what they've become. And just to put on the red, white, and blue and be part of that, be part of the, you know, United States and represent your country, I think it's certainly worthwhile, and given opportunity, I take it every time. And presently, I'm on the board for the 19 and under, helping select that team every year.
Who are your coaching mentors? Who are people that you reach out to? How much do you talk to your brother when it comes to coaching? Do you guys talk a lot? Do you not talk at all? Do you try to stay away from each other during the season? Who are you reaching out to? Who are you talking to about things coaching related?
Well, I talk to my staff, right? Like, you know, I'm kind of a self-made coach in a lot of ways. So there's nobody that, hey, I'm leaning on this guy or that guy. You know, if I have some thoughts and I want to work through some stuff, I'll get with my staff more than anything else. So I've done that. And like I said, my brother and I, we talk most every day. And, you know, it's like an older brother, younger brother relationship where, you know, I'm talking to him and trying to help him with things that he's looking for and trying to get better at and trying to help him on his team. So, you know, I feel pretty good about what we've been able to accomplish at Yale, and I'm kind of confident in what we do. So there's not a great need for me especially at this stage in my career, to reach out to others.
All right. I want to wrap it up with a final two-part question. Part one, when you look ahead over the next year or two, what do you see as being your biggest challenge? And then second part of the question, when you think about what you get to do every single day, you wake up in the morning, get out of bed, and you're heading into campus, what brings you the most joy? So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
Well, the biggest challenge I have is, maintaining the level of greatness that we've been able to come up with the last decade. You know, our team has been really good and we've been at the top of the league, and, you know, it feels good. It's nice to go to the NCAA tournament. It's great to win your conference and to win a championship and put numbers on the banner and hand out rings to people on campus that support your program. So all those things are really great, and we want to continue to do them. So maintaining the level that we've been at, that's something that's certainly going to be a big challenge. And, you know, the biggest joy I have is just being around my players. You know, we graduated EJ Jarvis, Isaiah Kelly, Matt Cotton, and Mike Feinberg this past year. And I'm going to miss all four of those guys. And they were great members of our community, but they were just good people, man. They were just good guys. And EJ Jarvis, you know, he's taking a grad year because he can't play at Yale anymore. He's going to play down in Florida. Matt Cotton's playing in at Hawaii. They're both grad transfers. And, you know, EJ was down in Florida for a six-week program, and he came up to Yale because he misses the place and misses his teammates. And he worked out with us somewhat before we went to Greece. And just seeing that kid smile just brings a joy to my face. And, you know, now I have several seniors that are going to be graduating, Matt Noling, Luke Kalaja, Yusuf Basa'ama, and our captain, August Mahoney. And I'm going to take a lot of joy in spending time with each of those guys every day because I won't be seeing them for a while after they graduate.
Before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share how people can connect with you, whether you want to share social media, email, website, whatever you feel comfortable with. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Well, I'm on Instagram. You know, I'm an old head, and one of my assistant coaches got me on Instagram. So, you know, I'll post something, you know, probably a few times a month. I'm on Yale Coach Jones on Instagram. And my email address is j.jones@yale.edu. And listen, if you get a chance to come out, if whoever's listening gets a chance to come out and watch Yale basketball, I think you'd be surprised at our level and what we're capable of. Like, you know, last year we finished the 65th best team in the country. And this season coming up should be one of the better teams that I've had to coach in my 25 years at Yale.
James, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule. Pleasure to meet you out at the Elite Camp early August, and really truly appreciative of your time. So to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the portfolio guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.